I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, columnist Ruben Navarrete, deputy managing editor for the National Review, Kevin D. Williamson, and screenwriter and graphic novelist John Ridley. I'm all by myself down here in Washington. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Good, thanks.
Feeling good, man. How's it going?
K-Dub, Hollywood, Happy New Year. A-Train, what's up? I'm not A-Train. We got the R. I'm sorry. What's up, everybody?
Yeah, people get it confused all the time.
I'm glad everybody's
here. Our politics are so similar. It's right. Amazing.
All right, well, let's jump into it. So the first week of 2011 brought lots of changes in not Hollywood, but Washington. The 112th Congress was sworn in, and with it, Democrats officially relinquished control of the House of Representatives to Republicans, Michelle.
And, yeah, of course, the new Speaker of the House is John Boehner of Ohio, and he took the gavel. And I'll just play a short clip from his opening remarks. Here it is.
We're going to make tough choices instead of avoiding them. That's why we're taking these first steps to repeal the job-killing health care law that was passed last year over the objections of the American people.
Just remember those words, the job-killing health care law.
I think that's the new official name of the legislation.
Yeah, I think we're going to get fleece jackets printed up with that in it. Anyway, go ahead, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, Ruben, now that the GOP is officially in control of the House, is trying to undo health care the best strategy to fix Congress, as Speaker Boehner likes to put it? Well?
Yeah. Well, what?
Well, is that the best way to fix the Congress?
I don't think so. You know what? The Republican stance on this has been that, we hear that you're talking about number one issue, jobs in the economy. But their claim is that if you do away with health care reform, that would be a way to take the pressure off of businesses and it would have a benefit on jobs in the economy. You can make that argument, but I think people want a much more direct approach to the issue of jobs in the economy. And I think most people see that when Democrats came in, they were serving a constituency and advancing a pet issue by going after and passing health care reform. Now, before you jump on me, now Republicans are doing the exact same thing in reverse. They're likewise advancing a pet issue and serving a constituency that wants to do away with health care reform. And that's what this is mainly about. It's about right-wing politics and going after and being able to claim a victory here. I think this is actually going to be good for both Republicans and Democrats to switch roles like this, because now Republicans no longer get to complain and throw rocks from the outside. They actually now have to lead and govern, and we're going to hold them accountable, and that's great. And likewise with Democrats, they're going to get a little change of pace. They're going to be able to throw rocks from the outside. It's going to be fun to watch them do that. So it's good to shake things up. I'm glad it happened.
Kevin.
Yeah, the difference is that the constituency the Republicans are trying to serve in this constitutes at the moment about 60% of the electorate. So I think they've probably got a better chance of doing it. Look, I think they're going to call every piece of legislation they don't like the jobs killing this or that and try to do that. And I agree, the health care bill is probably not what's keeping unemployment up near 10%. It's not the thing that's preventing investment. It's not the thing that's keeping the economy in the dumps. It's a bad and stupid piece of legislation. It ought to be repealed, but you ought to just repeal it because it's a bad and stupid piece of legislation. So, I think that's probably the direction they need to go on that. You know, I thought it was interesting that when they were handing over power in the House, that Nancy Pelosi actually gave a longer speech going out than John Boehner did coming in. I think that just says volumes about the differences between their temperaments.
Let me correct you about one thing, push back. That 60% figure, I've seen that both ways. I've seen 60% of Americans, 60, 70% of Americans support the bill, support health care reform, and I've heard Republicans say it in reverse. We're never going to solve that. There are people out there who don't like the specifics of this bill, but likewise, when Republicans come forward and said there's no problem with the health care system, people boo them out of the room.
Well, yeah, of course, and they should boo them out of the room because there are a lot of problems with the health care system, but you don't solve the problems with the health care system by, you know, entrenching the role of the insurance companies, you know, doing the mandates, the taxes, and all the additional spending. I mean, you're making the problems actually worse. So, yeah, if the Republicans came out and said our alternative is to do nothing and leave things as they are, well, yeah, they'd get laughed off the stage, as they should be.
Well, I do think that is a question, though, when you say, because we just did a report on this yesterday that suggests that there are certain aspects of the bill that, you know, large majorities don't like, well, about 60%, but overall it's about a 50-50 proposition. About 50% of the people, of the voters, like it, and about 50% of the voters don't. And so in that situation, you know, maybe Ruben, you want to take this. What, you know, who's the special interest group there?
Well, the special
interest
group.
It seems like we're right down the middle on this.
You mean on the Republican, on the Democrat
side? No, on the country. I'm not talking about Democrat or Republican. I'm saying down the country. It's true that Republicans are more united in their opposition to it. That's true. But if you look at sort of overall, it's a 50-50 split. So how can you say that there's a special interest here when the country's right down the middle?
Because Democrats have tried since Bill Bradley talked about putting health care out there for just kids, since Hillary Care, going back to Ted Kennedy and all of his career in Congress, this was a pet issue for Democrats. This was something they wanted to get done. They've been trying for a long time to get it done. Now Republicans feel like the gauntlet has been thrown down, and they've got to reverse it or repeal it to serve their constituency. All I'm saying here is that this is mostly about politics. It's not about helping the economy or jobs. And the real divide in the healthcare debate, is between Democrats who say the problem is more people need to be covered versus Republicans who say we need to do something about bringing down costs. And that's how you choose your terrain. You choose your terrain about how – that's why you have conflicting polls. But most people, I think, do not believe that the current system is working well.
Mm. John Ridley, what do you think? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I think the problem is that, now is when the chili hits the cheese. And you go through these election cycles where people crank up the rhetoric to 11, as they would say in Spinal Tap, and now you have to do something about it. Healthcare, it's not going to get repealed. It could get fixed. I don't think there's anyone out there who thinks it couldn't be fixed, but the idea that you're going to repeal it, A, it's not going to happen, and B, there's a downside to it. The Congressional Budget Office yesterday said that it's going to cost, if you repeal it, $142 billion in the next 9 years or so. So the idea that you have the Republicans who want to come in and should, I think, try to, A, get jobs and, B, reduce the deficit, this is not going to do it. And I believe, as was said, the problem is you have on the one hand the Democrats who are trying to get something done early and served their viewpoint. Now you have the Republicans who have to serve to a large part what they were campaigning on. But you get the public, which tends to get caught in the middle, and not much that needs to get done is going to get done if this is going to be the first thing out of the gate.
Jimmy, what do you think about this before we move on to Huck Finn and the N-word?
Yeah, I'm a little worried about this being the first thing out the gate, too, because it was so controversial. And I wonder if this is going to be the tone that they want to set, that they're going to be undoing all kind of changes down the line. It portends to like a really adversarial stance. It's not going to get a lot done.
But if you think it's wrong and if you think that's why you're there is to do the right thing, I mean, let's just take people at their word. They have a genuine belief that this is bad policy, bad for the country. Why would you wait? Why would you wait if you really and honestly believe this will wreck the economy, kill jobs, and so forth?
That's what they said about Obama at the same time with, look, get other things done first. Don't go after this.
Right.
And he said, look, this is important.
Sure.
I got to do it while I have the legislative power. You could make the same argument for the Republicans. And by the way, I think it's fair to make that argument. But at the same time, is this the number one most important thing when, as was said, jobs get the economy going?
Well, Republicans are about to make the same mistake. Republicans are about to make the same mistake Obama did, which is to blow a lot of political capital on an issue that people do not put at the top of their list.
All right.
The fact is they can repeal it, but creating jobs is something Congress just doesn't know how to do.
I don't know if they can repeal it. I don't know if the numbers are there for that. Let me just jump in and say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with author Jimmy Israel, Kevin D. Williamson of the National Review, columnist Ruben Navarrete, and commentator John Ridley. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. All right, fellas. Next up, the N-word in fine literature, not rap music, okay? The newest version of Huckleberry Finn replaces the N-word more than 200 times in the book with the word slave, Michelle. Really?
I think this is very interesting. I have to tell you, we had a big debate about this in the office. I just want to play a very short clip from an uncensored reading of the passage from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And if you're sensitive about the use of that word, then this is a good time to, get a cup of tea. And then I'm going to play another passage of the book, the same passage of the book with the word replaced with slave, which is what the editors of this version envisioned. That's their idea of the right thing to do here. So here it is. Now, this is a passage from the book where Huckleberry Finn is describing a drunken rant his father is having. Finn's father is complaining about how a particular free black man who he saw being able to vote. Here it is.
Thinks I, what is this country coming to? It was election day, and I was just about to go and vote myself if I weren't too drunk to get there. But when they told me there was a state in this country where they'd let that nigger vote, I drawed out. I says, I'll never vote again.
Now, that's performer Mark Divine. It's reading it's from an audio book. And now I'm going to reimagine what the new version would sound like, and we've replaced the word as the editors envision. Here it is.
Thinks I, what is this country coming to? It was election day, and I was just about to go and vote myself if I weren't too drunk to get there. But when they told me there was a state in this country where they'd let that
slave
vote, I drawed out. I says, I'll never vote again.
That is the worst thing I've ever heard.
You can almost see his lips moving there, yeah.
That's a David Letterman thing.
Right.
Go ahead.
Thanks for that,
ahead.
Michelle.
I'm just trying to make it real for you. I'm just trying to keep it real for you.
All right,
what do you think? Yeah.
John. John, check this out. Now, you wrote the Barbershop TV show on Showtime, the one based on the film. And how would you have felt if somebody tried to give you, any of your scripts the PC treatment like that?
Well, talking about literature, I mean, I would go to one of my books where I use the word and how that was changed. Here's my thing. I think that when that word comes up in modern society, it tends to overshadow larger issues. And I think people are focused on the word itself. Is it appropriate? Isn't appropriate? My concern on a few levels, one, just as a writer, Mark Twain in the past, when editors made changes to his work when he was still alive, obviously, was outraged by it. He didn't like it. And I think for a small-time outfit and a guy whose name I won't mention because I don't want to give him any more press than he deserves, who believes he is a Mark Twain scholar, who feels it is appropriate to go back and change the words. We're not talking about a translation from one language to another where there may be debate about the word or how it's used. We're talking about the English language, and also they are conflating a couple of books. They're taking Mark Twain and Huck Finn and making it into one massive book, which was obviously not done. That's wrong on its own level. And this is a little hyperbolic, but to me this guy is sort of the Mark David Chapman of literature.
Oh dear.
He's assassinating the work of an artist because he's in love with this guy.
A little hyperbolic.
Well, right. Let me...
I prefaced it. Let me say very quickly, my other issue with this, though, I think there's a sanitizing. This is not censorship, in my opinion. There's a sanitizing of the South, of slavery and of civil rights. You saw it happen with Holly Barbour, Governor of Mississippi. You see that going on with Texas right now in the textbooks where they're changing things about the civil rights movement, about Executive Order 9022 with the internment of Japanese Americans, things like that. That is wrong. The word itself is bad. It is nowhere nearly as bad as what slavery and the system of slavery was about. We don't teach that to our children, black or white or other, and to want to change it because we're sensitive about people's feelings is wrong. You wouldn't change the Diary of Anne Frank because you were worried about words that were used. You'd want people to know how horrible that was.
And is there anyone less likely?
We should want people to know.
Is there anyone less likely to be hurt by the contents of a book than an American public school student? I mean, these are the most illiterate, bad reading level kids on the earth. I mean, they're really worried about this going out and hurting
these
kids out
there. In other words,
they can't
read the book anyway.
So if we're really worried about kids being exposed to this word, I mean, I live in the South Bronx. It's as common a word as the. But certainly a great work of literature is the last thing on earth that's going to damage an American public school student.
I'd be lucky to get
them to the book.
Ruben, as a writer, I say change it. Here's why I say change it. And I thought about this. I thought about this initially. The one thing, writers care about the integrity of their work. They also want their work to be read. And the fact that this book has been banned so many places, not read, so many different generations now have lost out on this work because of this single word. If you change that one word, if you can get that book back into schools, then I think there's no harm done to it. What I find interesting about this debate is you can get African Americans voting on both sides of it, saying the word's offensive, take it out, versus, hey, because we want to be true to the offensiveness and not sanitize it, leave it in. It's a complicated debate for that reason. You can be a champion of the African-American community and still be torn on this issue. You can argue it, round or flat. That's what makes it a good topic. But I think that the really important thing is to get the book read again, to get it back into schools, and if changing one word does it, do it.
Jimmy, can I – don't tase me, but let me just play devil's advocate here.
don't tease me.
Okay. There's the whole question of – You talked about rap earlier, but artists sometimes do offer different versions of the same work. They'll say, okay, here's my radio-ready version of the work because I want to get the work out there. And then here's the adult version of it for people who are going to buy the work on their own or access the work on their own. Is this really any different to Ruben's point? I'm not taking a position on this. I'm just offering that as an idea. So, Jimmy, what do you think?
I guess what I'm wondering is, should we have a version of Michelangelo's David with boxers on, or maybe Venus de Milo where there's a version where she's wearing like a bathing suit? If we took the N-word out of literature, we wouldn't be reading James Baldwin, wouldn't be reading Ralph Ellison, wouldn't be reading Iceberg
Slim. No, that's not what I said, though. What I said is not taking it out, but taking it out to Ruben's point, taking it out for a specific audience to get them introduced to the work and saying when you're older, you can get the unexpurgated version.
You made the point that the author, I'm sorry,
who's that, Jim? I'm sorry,
this is John.
John?
You made the point that the author or the artist makes that decision in conjunction, obviously, with the studio or the record label or whatever. Mark Twain, when he was alive, went on record saying, I don't want other people changing my work. In fact, he said very sarcastically, take the editor.
Well, now he's dead.
So
it's not up to him
anymore. Yeah, he's not here anymore.
He is dead, but at the same time, when someone makes it explicitly clear, I don't want my work changed, I don't think it's right for someone else, by the way, who claims to be a scholar and claims to know this individual's wants and intentions, to say, well, fine, I'll take it and change it. I would not want my work changed 10 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. And by the way, because he's dead, I think goes to a larger issue of why, among other reasons, the copyright law needs to be extended beyond its 50 or 75 years so that the family, at least someone involved, could make a decision. But when someone has basically gone on record saying, I don't want changes, to simply say, I want to make a change. By the way, a small-time outfit that's trying to sell some books, take something out of the public domain, change it, re-enter it into the public
I'm sorry you don't have strong feelings about this, John. Next time, maybe we can get you to really come out of your shell and tell us.
I got up late this morning. I didn't have time to look at the topics. I'm
Kevin,
sorry.
Final question. Can I just the final thought from you on this? What about Ruben's point? Maybe it'll get more people to read it, and then when kids are older.
The fact that we would have to Baldwinize Mark Twain to get it into a public school classroom is an indictment of the schools and the people who run them. And if you're going to be changing something, you should be changing that and not the book.
I like that.
Well said.
I can live with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can live with that.
Here, here.
I'll co-sign that.
Okay. Okay.
Let's have Congress work on that first.
A rare moment of agreement in the shop. I don't know what kind of sort of agreement in the shop. That was Kevin D. Williamson. He's deputy managing editor of the magazine, The National Review. He's author of a new book out this month called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism. You can read an essay adapted from the book in this week's National Review. And he's with us from our bureau in New York. Jimmy Israel is author of the book, The Denzel Principle. He was with us from Mirror Station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete is a columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group and CNN.com. He was with us from San Diego. And John Ridley is a screenwriter, a graphic novelist, and Morning Edition commentator. He's with us from NPR West. Thank you all so much, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's talk more on Monday.